Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Whether or not human beings are exceptional is one of the most important questions of our age. Either we have unique value and moral responsibility, or we are just another animal in the forest. And if that is how we perceive ourselves, it is precisely how we will act. Most contemporary commentators about this crucial issue deny our exceptionalism. But now, making his second appearance on this podcast, Princeton professor Robert P. George has authored an important new book, Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, which argues in favor of human exceptionalism, although he doesn't use that term, and grapples with the issues that flow from that important understanding. George holds Princeton University's celebrated McCormick Professorship of Jurisprudence and is founder and director of Princeton's James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions. He has served as chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and as a presidential appointee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and the U.S. President's Council on Bioethics. He has also been the U.S. member of UNESCO's World Commission on the Ethics of Scientific Knowledge and Technology. A Phi Beta Kappa graduate from Swarthmore College, he holds the degrees of MTS and JD from Harvard University and advanced degrees from Oxford University, in addition to 23 honorary doctorates. He is a recipient of the U.S. Presidential Citizens Medal, the Honorific Medal for the Defense of Human Rights of the Republic of Poland, the Canterbury Medal of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, the Bradley Prize for Intellectual and Civic Achievement, the Barry Prize of the American Academy of Sciences and Letters, and Princeton's University President's Award for Distinguished Teaching. In other words, he is a very smart and accomplished guy. Robbie, welcome back to Humanize.
Well, it's great to be back with you, Brother Wesley.
Why did you pursue an academic life?
It was not what I expected to pursue when I was a boy. I was born and brought up in the heart of Appalachia in West Virginia. Both of my grandfathers were coal miners. I was the first in my family to even go to college, and I did not go to college with a view to becoming an academic. But when I arrived at Swarthmore, I was introduced to some thinkers and some ideas that were entirely new to me. And one of those thinkers was the ancient Greek philosopher Plato. And in a wonderful survey course of political thought that went from the ancient Greeks all the way to then contemporary writers like the great Harvard political philosopher John Rawls, I was introduced to Plato and to his dialogue called Gorgias, which raises the question, why do we engage in what you and I are doing right now, Wesley? Why do we engage in discussion, dialogue, debate? Why do we have conversations about abstract issues? Well, is it to show off? Is it to win victories? Is it to rise in the world? Is it to get more money, more power, better job? And of course, if anyone's familiar with the dialogue, they know that Plato brings us round to understanding that really the goal of dialogue, discussion, debate at the end of the day is not any of those things. That the real goal, the fundamental goal, is getting at the truth of things. Where the truth is sought, not simply as a means to other ends, wealth, power, status, prestige, influence, but as an end in itself. Because we human beings, one of the distinctive things about us, one of the exceptional things about human beings, is that an aspect of our fulfillment consists in our inquiring into questions, discerning lines of inquiry that will enable us to understand more deeply, to try to answer those questions, and sometimes even to get to answers, to sound correct answers, whether it's in the natural sciences or in the social sphere or in on theological questions or philosophical questions or just the ordinary stuff of our daily lives. We are by nature truth pursuers. And an aspect of our fulfillment does consist precisely in pursuing and, in our limited, fallible, imperfect way, sometimes getting to the truth of things.
That's one of the things that I think distinguishes us from all other life in the known universe, is that we do seek truth. And we will get into that because your book is about quite a bit about what makes us unusual, unique, and what that means in terms of what I call human exceptionalism. But let's have a little bit preliminary discussion first. Again, some of the chapters in your book, I noticed, are co-authored with other thinkers, which is a bit unusual. Why did you pursue that approach?
I think knowledge is very often, knowledge seeking is a cooperative enterprise. And some of the most important sorts of questions that I've pursued cooperatively with other people. A number of the co-authors are my students, my former students, who themselves have now gone on to careers in academia, some very distinguished careers in academia. And I love working with other people to try to get at the truth of things, sometimes by dialogue and debate, you know, where we actually disagree, but we're at least trying from our different perspectives to get at the truth of things. So we have a truth-inspired, truth-seeking debate. And other times where we do basically see things the same way, we're working together. We're supporting each other and trying to get at things. It's a cooperative enterprise. And a lot of those essays in the book, the chapters in the book, are the fruit of my cooperation with my former students and with others.
I think one of the hallmarks of your work is your willingness to dialogue with people you disagree. And even though we're not going to talk about that in this interview, your work with Cornel West, in terms of with whom you have strong differences in terms of policy,
that's for
but
sure.
You tour together and debate. Why do you do that?
Well, it began with our teaching together, and really my work with Cornell in the classroom and then on the road going to universities around the country and other forums to talk about the issues that divide us and also to talk about the things we're united on, like the importance of truth-seeking, the value of truth-seeking, the critical significance of freedom of speech, the virtues that are needed if we are to be truth-seekers. Really, one of the greatest blessings of my career has been working with Cornell in all of those areas. That kind of work is only possible because we don't see things the same way on a lot of questions, on a lot of political questions and other sorts of questions. But there is a fundamental sharing. We both believe that there is such a thing as truth. So we reject pure subjectivism or relativism or skepticism. Number two, this thing, the truth, is actually worth getting at. It's important. So the title of our new book together, the book that Cornell and I have written together, is called Truth Matters. And it really does matter. It's important to live in line with reality. And that means you have to know or at least have a pretty good idea of what reality is and what is illusion and what is false and what is unreality. So we believe in such a thing as truth. We believe that it's very important to get at the truth if we possibly can. We also share the belief that we'll never get there perfectly, never get there fully, that often the answers to questions simply open up more and deeper questions. So the conversation, the inquiry has to continue. And therefore, we believe in the importance of freedom of speech, freedom of inquiry, freedom of thought, freedom of discussion. And we both share the belief that certain virtues need to be inculcated. We have to inculcate them in ourselves, and we have to try to inculcate them in our children and in our students and anyone over whom we have any influence. And those are virtues like intellectual humility, a recognition of one's own fallibility, the recognition that we are wrong about some things, no matter who we are, no matter how brilliant we are, no matter how accomplished we are, no matter how celebrated we are, we're wrong about some things. We just don't know which ones we're wrong about. We know that in our head, we've got a mixture of true beliefs and false beliefs. we need to be able to swap out as many of those false beliefs as we can and replace them with true beliefs. But unless we acknowledge that there are some false beliefs there, we're not going to be open to the kind of criticism that will enable us to realize that certain beliefs that we hold are
that
false.
The humility is necessary for persuasion in the sense of both persuading others and being persuaded ourselves.
Well, that's certainly true. But another thing that Cornell and I share is that we're not fundamentally interested in persuading other people, not fundamentally interested in persuading each other even. I mean, I don't sit up at night worried that Cornell continues to disagree with me, despite the fact that I've given him all these great arguments and this great evidence, because I recognize that I could be wrong about things. And my real interest in talking to Cornell is not so much persuading him to believe what I believe. It's relying on him to raise questions and offer criticisms and challenges to what I believe, so that on those matters on which I'm wrong, and I know there are some, and I know they're not just the trivial, superficial, minor things, I could be wrong about some big, important things, on those matters, I might be able to move from a mistaken position to the truth, or at least nearer to the truth of things. And again, that's something that Cornell and I share. We're not like focused on persuading each other. Thank God we're not. And we're not just trying to put on a show, you know, it's not a display. It's not entertainment. Although, you know, try to be a little entertaining, but you know, it's not what the purpose of the enterprise is. The purpose of the enterprise is jointly, despite our disagreements, working with our disagreements, trying to get at the truth of things.
Let's get to your book, Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth, subtitle Law and Morality in Our Current Moment. You know, it's so full, I think I could do 3 shows on its content, which we can't do now, but let's start here. You write that we're living in an age of feeling and that isn't good. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, Wesley, the historians, some historians in any case, are very fond of breaking up the epochs, the eras, into the age of this and the age of that. And so, for example, they'll tell us that the medieval period was the age of faith. Now, what do they mean by that? Well, they mean that for the great medieval thinkers, whether they are from the Christian tradition, like St. Thomas Aquinas or St. Anselm, the Jewish tradition, Moses Maimonides, the Islamic tradition, people like Averroes, regardless of their tradition of faith, for all of the great medieval thinkers, the ultimate touchstone of truth, and therefore of goodness, of justice, of right, was conformity of our beliefs with the teachings of the faith, the teachings of the religion, the teachings of the Bible or the Quran, whatever the holy book was of the particular tradition. When historians say that the medieval period was the age of faith, that's an oversimplification. And yet there is a truth in it. It is certainly true that for the great medieval thinkers, a certain priority was given to conformity with the doctrines of the religion. Now, we have to be careful here because it is also an oversimplification, and we could be misled into supposing that the medievals were focused exclusively on conformity with religious teaching and didn't give a high place to rational inquiry or rational understanding or to reason. That's actually the reverse of the truth. Anybody who knows anything about the great medieval thinkers of any of the 3 great monotheistic traditions knows that these were men who placed a very high premium on reason. They believed, as I myself believe, in the harmony, the mutual supporting nature of faith and reason. And yet it's still not false, it's true, to say that the medievals did give ultimate pride of place to conformity with the teachings of faith, and that therefore it makes sense to call the medieval period, or refer to the medieval period as the age of faith. Now, the same historians that tell us that the medieval period is the age of faith tell us that the Enlightenment era in Europe, the era of the European Enlightenments in Germany and France and Scotland and England, was the age of reason, or sometimes they say the age of science. Now, again, that's a bit of an oversimplification, but it's also true. It captures a certain truth. And that is that for the great Enlightenment thinkers, the ultimate touchstone of truth and therefore of goodness, of justice, of right, is conformity of our beliefs with the findings of rational inquiry. For example, scientific inquiry or social scientific inquiry. Now, again, we need to be careful because it is an oversimplification, not to be misled into supposing that all of the great Enlightenment thinkers were secularists or atheists. They certainly weren't. Now, there were some, especially in France, but even there, not all of the great, far from all of the great Enlightenment thinkers were secularists. Many were religious believers. In England, you can begin that list with Sir Isaac Newton, for example, a very devout Christian, a man of very firm theological beliefs. And yet it is true that they did, the Enlightenment figures across the European continent did place a certain premium on reason. Well, if the medieval period is the age of faith, at least in some sense, and if the Enlightenment era is the age of reason, I ask myself, Wesley, in what era do we live? How would we characterize our epoch? And here I regret to say it is not the age of reason. It's not the age of faith. It's not the age of faith and reason, which I would love it to be. Rather, it's the age of feeling. Because what do so many people today, especially but not exclusively young people today, treat as the ultimate touchstone of truth and therefore of goodness, of justice, of right? It's not conformity with the teachings of religion. It's not conformity with the findings of rational inquiry. It rather has to do with feeling, with how I feel about it. Conformity with my emotions. And so people will suppose something's true or not true, depending on how they feel about it. In fact, it's gotten to the point where people have persuaded themselves that someone is a man or a woman, depending on whether they feel like a man or feel like a woman. And it has nothing to do with one's actual biological makeup, one's biological organization toward reproduction. If one is biologically organized to produce the large gamete, the female gamete, if one is biologically organized to produce the small gamete, the male gamete. And I think this is catastrophic because although our reason is frail and imperfect, we are fallen creatures. And although faith has not always been the most reliable guide to truth, the religions have gone off the rails in various areas. The most unreliable guide to truth is our feelings and emotions because they go very wayward very quickly.
Yeah, the very ephemeral.
Prone to selfishness, yeah. To greed, to lust, to envy, to anger, all of these wayward emotions, which can lead us astray so badly and so swiftly.
And what I feel today, as you said, I may not feel tomorrow. So if I think A is true today because I feel it, and tomorrow I feel B is true, there is no bedrock upon which to found principles.
That's absolutely true. And that's why you hear people today, again, especially but not exclusively young people, will say things like, well, you have your truth and I have my truth. Or that's your truth, but something else is my truth. They imagine that we've somehow repealed the law of non-contradiction, that something cannot both be and not be in the same respect at the same time. And, Wesley, I would note that this kind of subjectivism, because our feelings are subjective, and if we treat feeling as the ultimate arbiter of right and wrong, of true and false, we're falling into a kind of subjectivism. This subjectivism is really quite unlike the sort of polite cocktail party relativism that you and I remember from our own days as students. You know, when I was a kid, at least, or when I was a student myself in college, you know, at a cocktail party or in a freshman class, you would hear people say things like, well, there's no such thing as objective truth. There's only opinion. You have your opinion. I have my opinion. Now, that was a very unsatisfactory position. It can't even sustain itself against self-contradiction because somebody who is alleging that there is no such thing as truth is actually making a truth claim in the very allegation that there's no such thing as truth. But it was, in any case, this polite relativism of our youth was directed toward a kind of tolerance or liberty. The idea was, well, you shouldn't impose your values on somebody else because, you know, there's really no such thing as truth and you just have your opinion and I have my opinion. So we should tolerate each other's opinions and not get too worked up over things and certainly not interfere with each other's liberty. Bad argument, but nevertheless, there was a certain innocence to it. Today's subjectivism, I have my truth and you have your truth, is in no way polite and it's in no way tolerant and it's in no way respectful of liberty. It has become extremely intolerant and authoritarian. It's what gave you during peak woke that ugly phenomenon of cancel culture. If you don't agree with me, if you don't affirm me and my feelings, if you challenge me in any way, then you're a monster. You're a bad person. You're somebody who is to be unpersoned. You're to be canceled. Your career is to be ruined. Your life is to be ruined. You're to be drummed out of the human race. And we saw the concrete consequences for lots of good people who became victims of woke attack mobs and whose careers were ruined and whose lives were ruined.
And getting back to the title, seeking truth doesn't, whatever is true, doesn't depend on how you feel about it.
No, that's certainly right. I mean, you know, the
you may feel terribly about what you discern to be true, and also if we feel good about something, that doesn't make it right, because sometimes doing the very wrong thing feels great, and sometimes doing the right thing feels terrible.
That's exactly right, and all of human experience confirms exactly what you said. But we nevertheless have very good reasons to, in the words of the great Soviet dissident and Christian thinker Alexander Solzhenitsyn, we have very good reasons to not live by lies. Sometimes it would be very comfortable to live with illusions, live with falsehoods. It's more pleasant. Believe things that it's pleasant to believe and avert our eyes, avert our gaze from the truth of things. We can be tempted to kind of walk into the kind of world of falsehood, like the Matrix, where nothing's real. We're not dealing with the real world. We're imagining making up our own world and trying to live in it. But that's not actually a human way of living. That we're not being true to ourselves at all there. Quite the contrary. We're fleeing from reality. And that is always disastrous in the end.
Yeah. And I've kind of tilled this field as well. And in my speeches, I urge people, don't say, I feel this, I feel that. Train yourself, because we've been trained to do that. Say, yeah. I think this, I think that, if that's what you're talking about. Obviously, if you're saying, well, I feel love for my wife, that's a different situation. Let's move to universal human dignity, a non-equivocal dignity. You spend many pages defending that principle. To me, that isn't controversial, but many these days oppose the idea of unique human dignity or human exceptionalism. What are some of the bases of their opposition?
Well, some of it is just straight up materialism, that there's no such thing as a world beyond the material or an aspect of the world that's beyond the material aspects of the world. And so we must be just like every other material creature in the world. There's nothing special about us, and therefore we have no special standing, no special worth, no special, to use the word, dignity. People will suddenly flee to the idea of dignity as soon as their own dignity is offended or challenged, or if they're relegated to the status of a mere thing or a mere object or a mere instrument, or if they're treated the way, you know, we routinely treat non-human reality as a mere means to our personal ends. But I think that's a very bad mistake, because I think there are things that are very, very special and unique about human beings and that do confer upon us a standing, a worth, a dignity, that do mean that we're not mere things, you know, like farm animals or
but even farm animals aren't mere things. I mean, they have emotions, they have feelings, they feel pain, and of course, that's why we have animal welfare. Yeah, that's why we have animal welfare laws, because we not only have unique dignity and unique value, but we also have moral obligations. One of which I believe is to treat animals humanely.
Well, that's true, but animals, of course, don't have that obligation.
Correct. Correct. The concept of animal rights is nonsensical.
Yeah, the tiger does not have the moral obligation even to deliberate, much less to refrain, even to deliberate about whether to kill the gazelle.
Yes.
The tiger's just acting on instinct and impulse, and that's all there is available for the tiger, because the tiger lacks something that human beings have, which is a rational nature.
That's right. Yeah. And
that's, I think, the ultimate source of our dignity, that we, and it's what makes possible moral deliberation and moral judgment, and imposes on us moral obligations.
Right. You're right.
You know, the way this is, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Wesley. Very, very articulately about how rationality is, in your view, the thing that truly distinguishes us from all other known life. But I've been in this argument before myself with others, and they'll say, yes, but not every human being has that capacity. But you use the word nature, and I think the word nature is the key, as opposed to whether I presently have that capacity as a human being, which might be impeded by immaturity, it might be impeded by injury or illness. But you use the word by our nature. And I think that's the key. So explain that.
Yeah. So I think what a person is a being with a rational nature. We human beings are animals. In those ways, we're like tigers and gazelles. we're an animal, but we're rational animals. That is, our nature is a rational nature. Now, what does that mean? That means that we are organized for deliberation, judgment, inquiry, ultimately choice and action. That we're not simply at the mercy. We're organized. Our nature is such that we're not simply at the mercy of our emotions or feelings or drives or instincts. Now, we have emotions, we have feelings, we have drives, we have instincts, but we can exercise control over them if we're willing to do it. Now, we can abdicate that responsibility and we can just act as if we were brute animals. We can become predators, but we don't have to. Our rational nature is what makes it possible for us to, in a certain sense, transcend our feelings, our emotions, our desires, our drives, our passions, our compulsions. So I think what ultimately matters, the ultimate source of our dignity, is not the immediately exercisable capacities for deliberation, judgment, and choice, but rather the root capacities, those radical, in the sense of root, radical capacities for those things, which we have not only when we're awake, but when we're asleep. Which we have not only when we're talking to each other as we're talking to each other right now, Wesley, but also if one or the other or both of us happens to be under a complete anesthesia.
Or even in a coma.
Or in a coma. We, a severely congenitally, cognitively disabled person is still a creature with a rational nature, even if there's some congenital, let's say, genetic impairment to realizing and actually being able to make immediately exercisable those radical capacities. And we can see that this is the case if we just conduct a little thought experiment. Imagine that either by a miracle or imagine that some new therapy or drug is developed that enables someone who is congenitively, severely cognitively disabled to overcome that disability and begin functioning without any disability. In that miracle occurring or in that therapy being applied or that drug being taken, have you changed that creature, that being, from one kind of thing into another? Have you changed it from one species into another? No, you haven't changed it fundamentally at all. Rather, you have enabled it to be perfected as the kind of thing it already is. Now, notice the difference. If a miracle made a horse talk, what you would have there is no longer a horse. You wouldn't be perfecting a capacity that's being impeded in the horse right now. You would be creating a new capacity that isn't in the organization of the horse. And I think that establishes very clearly that even the severely cognitively disabled person, congenitally cognitively disabled person, is the bearer of, has, possesses a rational nature. And the respect that he is due is equal to the respect due to anybody else. He's an end and not a mere means. He's a person, not a mere thing. We can't just harvest his organs to save other people precisely because he is the bearer of a rational nature. Now, if that's true, then you're a bearer of a rational nature if you have Alzheimer's disease. You're a bearer of a rational nature if you're a 6-month fetus or even a 4-day-old human embryo. You're a bearer of a rational nature if you're in a coma or in a minimally conscious state of the sort that famously Terry Schiavo was in. You do not lose your human dignity because your dignity is founded upon your nature as a rational creature, which is sustained irrespective of whether you happen at the moment to possess the immediately exercisable capacities that you're organized to exercise.
So you're saying, and I, of course, agree with this, that human beings have objective value, intrinsic value, merely because they're human, based on that we all have a rational nature.
That's what it means to believe in human dignity. That's right. And to believe in human rights. So anybody who tells you he believes in human rights, Wesley, who believes that our dignity is somehow acquired and not inherent, is telling you a lie because he doesn't believe in human rights. Rights you have simply in virtue of your humanity.
Exactly, because if it depends on your ability to actually have a capacity, meaning exercise, let's say, that rationality.
Yeah, and immediately then, exercisable capacity.
Then no one is safe, because any one of us at any time can lose our ability to actually engage in that capacity. If, let's say, I walked out of my house and a tree branch fell on my head. It's just, or Terry Schiavo, who you brought up and whose case I was deeply involved in, had a cardiac arrest. And there were people who said, well, because she had a cardiac arrest that caused a brain injury that was so significant, she couldn't engage in the same kind of rationality that you and I are currently engaging in, her value was less. Therefore, she, instead of being a subject, she could become an object. And that's how, when you talk to people like the utilitarian philosopher with whom you've crossed intellectual swords, Peter Singer, he might say, well, she's no longer a person because she doesn't have that capacity. And an animal who has higher capacities than her could be a person. And that leads to the destruction of universal human rights.
Yes, that's exactly what Peter thinks. And of course, he has the integrity to not claim to be an advocate of human rights. He doesn't think that there are rights people have simply in virtue of their humanity. In fact, as a utilitarian, as a more broadly speaking consequentialist, he doesn't believe in rights, strictly speaking, at all, that the right thing to do in any particular case is the thing that will overall maximize utility. And the concept of rights just has no role to play in that. But for Peter, for people like him, there are some human beings who are persons, and then there are some human beings who, though they are human beings, and to his credit, he doesn't claim they're not human beings. He knows as a matter of biological fact that even the five-day-old embryo, the six-month-old fetus, the cognitively disabled child, the person with Alzheimer's disease, the person in Terry Schiavo's condition are all human beings. He thinks those are categories of human beings who are not persons. Therefore, they're not distinguishable as persons from things. They are not bearers of dignity. They don't have interests that really count in the moral equation. So he thinks there's some human beings who are not yet persons, though they could in the future become persons. The unborn, the newly born, those with cognitive disabilities that could be cured. There are some human beings who were once persons but are no longer persons. Those with advanced Alzheimer's disease or other dementias, those in long-term comas. And then there are some human beings who never were and never will be and are not now, of course, persons, severely congenitally cognitively disabled human beings. But I reject all that. So I don't think there's such a thing as a human being who is not a person, a human being who is not a bearer of rights. So I can claim and do claim that there are such things as human rights. Rights that we have simply in virtue of our humanity.
In fact, this is the backbone of Western civilization, the unique and intrinsic dignity of human beings, which leads to, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and so forth. If you do not have the understanding that you've just expressed, Thomas Jefferson is out the window.
You bet he is. That claim, that profound, deep, central claim of the Declaration of Independence is just a lie. If there's no such thing as human beings that are bearers of profound, inherent, and equal dignity. And notice that the only way you actually get to the Declaration, to the idea that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, is with Genesis 1. It's with the Bible. It's with the belief that human beings, though mere material stuff made from the dust of the earth and someday will die and dissolve, nevertheless are made in the very image and likeness of God. Now, what does that mean to say that we're godlike? What could that possibly mean? Does it mean that human beings have five fingers on each of two hands and hair on his head and a nose? Well, no. Believers in God believe that God is spiritual, not material. So it can't be that. So in what respect are we godlike as the foundation of our dignity? What could that mean? Well, I think what it means is that like God, we human beings are by nature able to envisage states of affairs that do not currently obtain, to see the intelligible point of bringing those states of affairs into existence, and then of acting on reason, the reasons given by those values that we could instantiate by our actions, to act on reasons freely, not on impulse or instinct like a brute animal, to bring those states of affairs into existence. Now, we're not infinite the way God is infinite. We're not perfect the way God is infinite, perfect. We're very finite and we're very imperfect. And yet we share this godlike capacity to envisage states of affairs that don't exist, to understand the point, the value of bringing them into existence, and then being able to act freely on the reasons that we have apprehended to bring those states of affairs into existence. Once you've got that in place, you've got the predicate for all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. So there is an arc that runs from Genesis 1 to the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. They're part of a package. You can't have the one without the other.
But even if you don't have faith that Genesis 1 is true, the West is predicated upon, let's say, Judeo-Christian moral philosophy. So even atheists, such as my late and wonderful friend Nat Hentoff,
yes,
who was an atheist, but he was a devoted civil libertarian, believed in universal human equality. He was pro-life on abortion because he said what matters is being human. And if you don't believe that being human is what matters, you cannot have universal human rights. He was very vigorous in that defense, even though he did not have the faith understanding that you express.
Absolutely right. And I remember him very well. He's a dear friend of mine as well. The great Nat Hentoff was a great pro-life champion. But notice that you don't have to be a theist, much less Jewish or Christian. You don't even have to be a theist to recognize the reality that's pointed to in Genesis 1. And that is, we really do have these powers of reason and freedom, these godlike powers. Now, you might not buy, if you're an atheist, you don't buy the story that, well, the reason we have them is that God shares them with us, that God endows us with those powers. But nevertheless, you can understand just from your own experience and your observations of the world that, boy, human beings are unlike any other critter. We really can envisage states of affairs that don't exist, see the point of bringing them into existence, and then act freely and on reasons to bring them into existence. Tigers can't do that. Gazelles can't do that. Amoeba can't do that. Bats can't do that. You know, chickens can't do that. Ears of corn can't do that. But human beings can do it and do it.
Yeah, your West Virginia just came out with the term critter, and pretty soon we'll be talking about the hollows, right?
Heritage, that's
I'll
pull out my banjo and play a little Foggy Mountain Breakdown if you're not careful.
You're anticipating where I'm going to go toward the end of this interview, so we'll pretend you didn't say that. Just for readers, we've gone through maybe 50 pages, the first 50 pages of Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth. It is such a rich source of material to think about and ponder its importance. I want to get to the next question I get to before I run out of time, which is moving upon us. What is natural law and why is it important?
So natural law is the body of principles, including moral norms, that provide us with reasons, including more than merely instrumental reasons and including moral reasons for our actions. Our grasp of natural law begins with our grasp of the intelligible point of various sorts of activities. For example, truth seeking, what you and I are engaged in right now in our conversation. It's got a point. What's the point? To try to get at the truth of things. Scholarly research, reading books, doing inquiries, doing any kind of investigation where your goal is to get at the truth. What you're doing there is you're after.
Or even a child touching a hot stove and then realizing it's hot.
Or exactly right, or a kid taking apart a toy,
yes,
trying to figure out how it works. I mean, we naturally, that is just by our natural unaided human reason, desire to know certain things, and we devise strategies for getting at the answers to those questions, and we have an intelligible reason for doing it. Natural law is all about the reasons we have for things, and the pursuit of knowledge is as far from the only such reason. We have many such fundamental reasons, that is, more than merely instrumental reasons for action. There are many aspects of human well-being and fulfillment. Another one, obviously, is friendship. It's another thing we're doing right now. We're renewing an old friendship by getting together here and working together, trying to get at some questions. We grasp the intelligible point of friendship in a non-inferential act of understanding that's a real act of understanding. We realize that Ebenezer Scrooge, prior to the visit from the ghosts who straighten him up, is missing a profound truth when he misses the point of friendship. He's got everything upside down and backwards. He's treating a merely instrumental good, namely money, as if it's intrinsically good. And he's treating a true intrinsic good, friendship, as if it's merely instrumentally good. The only so-called friend he ever had was Jacob Marley, and his, quote, friendship with Marley wasn't a friendship at all. It was just a mutually advantageous relationship. And what Dickens, as the writer there, is taking advantage of is our natural grasp of the intelligible point of friendship. We can see right off the bat that there's something wrong, something screwy about Scrooge. He's got things backwards. Money's not intrinsically valuable. Friendship is. And what we've grasped when we grasp the good of friendship is another foundational principle of natural law. And there are others. There's beauty. There's the pursuit of a good character, not in order to show off to people or get ahead or for something else, but just for the intrinsic benefit of being a person of virtue, a person of good character. And there are more and more. There are a diverse range of reasons for action. And our grasp of the first principles of natural law is our grasp of the intelligible points of engaging in those activities for which we have those kinds of reasons to engage. And then there's a second level, a second order of reasons, and those are moral reasons. Those are reasons that follow from the overall directiveness of the range of human goods that fulfill us as human creatures: knowledge, friendship, beauty, good character, you know, and more. Those are norms like do unto others as you'd have them do unto you, or the end doesn't justify the means. A good end doesn't justify a bad means. Or more specific moral principles like thou shalt not kill, steal, commit adultery, bear false witness against your neighbor, or very, very specific moral norms like when you tell your little boy, don't hit your sister. That's a very specific moral norm that follows from those underlying principles of natural law.
So natural law is
just
a
reason's
way
grasp of what should be done and should be avoided.
Natural law is a way for us to discern the truth of what is right and wrong?
Yeah, well, it's broader than that, but it includes that. It's the truth of what is right and wrong, but more fundamentally, it's the truth of what is worth pursuing and what is not worth pursuing, what is worth doing and what is not worth doing, what is worth having and what is not worth having.
Are you talking about living a virtuous life?
Certainly, that's right. And remember, knowledge of natural law is knowledge of moral reality that we have independent of any special revelation.
And how do we have that knowledge beyond special revelation?
I think just in virtue of our rational natures, that we're capable of grasping, for example, the intelligible point of having and being a friend, even if you're not going to get anything out of it. Where you go to visit your friend who's dying at 3 a.m. in the hospital, barely aware that you're there, you know, perhaps, you know, woozy from the narcotic painkillers, but you're there to be by his side and to hold his hand, and you're not expecting to get into the will, and you're not expecting to get anything else out of doing it. It's a pure act of friendship. That's not an irrational act. We can all see, unless we're Ebenezer Scrooge, that that's not an irrational act. That's a perfectly rational act. We've grasped something important about what's worth doing and not worth doing. And we've grasped something important there without grasping a moral norm. We haven't gotten to moral norms yet. You might not have a strict moral obligation to go visit your friend. You might have conflicting, maybe you have an obligation to be in another town. Maybe you have an obligation to be, you know, at home with your children. But nevertheless, we can grasp the intelligible point of a pure act of friendship.
So you just referenced moral norms. Different societies have radically different moral norms, which they came to through different means. How do we reconcile that there's truth in all of these different moral norms?
Well, of course, the reality of an objective morality can exist, and I believe does exist, quite independent of whether we all agree with it. In fact, the objective truth would be the objective truth even if no one knew it, even if no one affirmed it. And something that's not true doesn't become true even if 100% of everybody affirms it. the whole reason that we engage in moral inquiry in the first place, that you do moral philosophy, that you do the kind of work that I myself do, is because you recognize that different people in different societies have reached different judgments about these things. And so we need to assess the reasoning leading to those judgments to decide who gets it right or nearer to fully right and who gets it wrong. So disagreement and difference, far from terminating the discussion of morality, is what launches inquiry into morality.
Again, we're running short on time. I could go for another half hour on this line of questioning, but let's move a little deeper into the book. You get into some issues that impact these thoughts and these subjects. And you write about natural law on medical issues such as abortion, euthanasia, and medical conscience. But because of time constraint, let's just focus on one core question, which I often hear advanced these days. Whether there is a right, as many politicians and activists say, to health care. You address that in the book. Is there a right to health care? And before you answer that, what exactly is a right?
Okay. So a right is the something that is correlative to somebody else's obligation. You have a right that I pay you $5 if and only if I have a duty to pay you $5. There's no such thing as a right that floats free of anybody else's duties. So to speak coherently of rights, if we're going to use the language of rights, and we don't have to, there are ways of stating all the important moral propositions that we need to worry about without the language of rights. But there's nothing wrong with using that language. And in some ways, it's helpful to use that language. But we mustn't speak just abstractly of, well, I have a right to this and he has a right to that. Those rights hold, they obtain, if and only if they correspond to somebody's duty. So if someone is saying there's a right to health care and meaning by that, that there is a right to a government-provided system of health care, then I say, got it wrong. There is no right to a government-assisted, a government-funded or government-run health care system. It's not necessarily wrong to have a government-run system. It's a prudential judgment whether there should be a government-run system or whether there should be an essentially private system or an insurance system of some sort. Or perhaps there should be, in a particular society, the most prudent judgment would be that there would be some mix of public and private funding or management of the healthcare system. There's no absolute moral obligation here beyond the very abstract and general obligation that we as a society should organize things so that people who need healthcare are best in a position to get the healthcare they need at affordable costs. But whether that should be government run, private, some mix of government and private, whether it should be fundamentally private, but with a government safety net, all of those are prudential judgments. So given that they're prudential judgments on which there is no certainty, no moral, strict moral truth, then there is no moral right corresponding to them.
So I think you're describing the distinction between what is a right and what might be good policy.
Exactly right.
And good policy does not necessarily mean it's a right. It's what the society in question may have determined as the best approach to this particular subject.
Exactly right. When we're talking about what are sometimes called positive rights, that is not negative rights. Negative rights are rights that somebody not do something, like rights that the government not violate your freedom of speech or your freedom of religion or your freedom to criticize the government and those things, those negative rights. When we're talking about positive rights, we're ordinarily in a domain where there are many different morally acceptable ways of fulfilling the need that we're seeking to fulfill. And so a choice has to be made among those mutually exclusive, but nevertheless morally acceptable possibilities, which choice cannot be dictated by the application of a moral norm. Right? So you're just going to have to decide for this society at this time, given its history, its traditions, its circumstances, what is the wisest policy? And very often when it comes to positive rights, there are trade-offs. So let's, for example, say that a community finds itself deliberating between, shall we build a library for this town or shall we build a swimming pool and recreational complex? Now, you could say, build both, because people have a right to recreation and people have a right to learning. So build both the library and the swimming pool. But of course, the trouble is when we're in the domain of positive goods, positive so-called rights, we're working with limited resources. The government can always not interfere with your freedom of speech. That never costs the government anything, is don't interfere with people's freedom of speech. But governments sometimes have to decide, or democracies, people have to decide, how are we going to use these resources, the money that we have? We don't have enough for both a swimming pool and recreational center and a library. We've got to make a choice. Notice that you can't make that choice by trying to decide whether there's a right to a library as opposed to a right to a swimming pool, or whether there's a right to both a library and a swimming pool. This is a policy judgment that's going to be determined in the end by prudential judgment, and in some cases, just by the public's preferences, not by the application of a moral norm. And that distinguishes it from negative rights like free speech or the right not to be enslaved. That's an absolute right. That's not a question of how we're going to allocate resources. That's not a prudential judgment. That's not a policy matter. It's a strict moral principle. If human beings have worth and dignity, equal worth, inherent dignity, then you can't enslave them. It took human beings a long time to figure that out, but that's the truth of the matter.
Because slavery treats equals as unequals.
Exactly. It treats some, although they are, from the moral point of view, equal, it treats some as inferior and some as superior. And that's also intrinsically wrong.
And it's evil, because I think evil can be defined as, and by the way, I'm going to be doing a show in the future on what is evil, what is the nature of evil. But I think evil, at least one definition I like, is treating any human being as an object instead of a subject.
That certainly is evil, because it's a fundamental violation of the dignity of human beings.
Also, when you were talking about positive rights and so forth, getting back to our earlier discussion at the top of the program, you can't make that decision, at least in a smart way, based on feelings.
No, exactly right. You're going to head down the wrong road if you try to do it on the basis of how do we feel about things. This goes to the point you made earlier, that you encourage people to not speak in terms of I feel that or he feels that, but rather I think that or he thinks that. You need to think about these things. Even in the domain of prudential judgment, you know, you at least need to begin by thinking, okay, what do we have? What resources do we have? Let's first do an audit. What do we have available? Then what do we already have for our children in this community? Maybe we've got some we don't have a pool, but we've got some playgrounds, or we've got some other recreation facilities, but we don't have anything really to advance learning. So maybe since we've got some playgrounds and we've got some recreational facilities, even though we don't have a pool, we've got a hockey rink, but we don't have a pool, these resources we would be really better off spending on a library. Now that's all the fruit of thinking, not feeling.
Right. I'm looking at the clock and I'm getting very upset. You close the book focusing on seekers of truth and bearers of witness, which I thought was interesting. These are people who you admire. You brought up Alexander Solzhenitsyn before, which happens to be the person I was going to ask you about. You did that to me twice in this interview. Who was Alexander Solzhenitsyn, for those who may not know, and why is he included in your book?
Well, during the Cold War, he was the great Soviet dissident. He was a very distinguished man of letters, a novelist, an essayist. He wrote very important works that had a very high political valence. They were not so subtle critiques of Soviet gangsterism, of totalitarianism, of the quashing of basic civil liberties. You will recall, I'm sure, the Gulag Archipelago. And of course, the Soviets couldn't stand having a voice of truth, a very religious man, by the way, a Russian Orthodox Christian, a voice of truth, speaking truth to their power. And so they exiled him. And he ended up in exile here in the United States. And in 1978, when I was myself a graduate student at Harvard, he came to Harvard to speak, to give the commencement address.
You saw that famous address?
It wasn't inside the walls. Now, Cornell West was inside the walls because it was his graduation year. But I was outside the walls listening over the loudspeaker. So I didn't see, but I heard the address. And in that address, he did not do what Harvard expected him to do, which was to spend all his time on his life's work, condemning Soviet gangsterism and totalitarianism and evil. Instead, he gave a very powerful critique of Western decadence, and especially of what he called the loss of courage in the West. He condemned pornography and sort of licentiousness. And gosh, I mean, Harvard wasn't ready for this. He was treated as if he was some sort of ingrate. You know, they invited him here. They gave him an honorary degree. They gave him the opportunity to speak. And he criticized the land that had given him refuge, you know, as an exile. But he was doing us a favor. He was holding a mirror up to us. He was making us look at our own failings. It was a very powerful speech. And then 5 years later, as I point out in the essay in the book, 5 years later, he gave another important speech. It's when he won the Templeton Prize. And at the prize ceremony, I don't know if he knew he was echoing Abraham Lincoln. I don't know about his knowledge of American history. It might have been just a coincidence, but he gave an account of why the West was falling into decay. And he said exactly what Abraham Lincoln had said in his proclamation of a day of fasting and repentance during the Civil War. Solzhenitsyn said, "We are in this condition because men have forgotten God. We have forgotten God. We have imagined in our pride that we are God, that we get to make the rules, that we get to make up reality, that there's no reality over against us that we have to observe and live in line with." I was just stunned when I heard about that speech. That's not a speech I actually heard being given. I wasn't at the Templeton Prize. But when I heard about the speech, saw it quoted, and then later read the speech, the echo with Lincoln during the Civil War was just like an explosion in my head. I said, gosh, these prophets, they always give us the same message. And they give us the same message because it's true. How do we end up falling into this decadence? It's when we imagine we're what's ultimate and we lose our sense of something beyond ourselves. Men have forgotten God.
And there are tremendous adverse consequences that flow directly therefrom. So he's in the book because you believe he was a truth seeker and a truth speaker.
Absolutely right. And sometimes sincere truth seekers who are also courageous truth speakers, whether they like it or not, assume the role of the prophet. And so men like Alexander Solzhenitsyn, or I also mention Heinrich Heine, the great German Jewish Christian poet of the East. They're our modern day, our modern era Isaiahs and Jeremiahs. They're telling us stuff we don't want to hear, but that we need to hear because it's true and we have lost our way.
This is a very important book. And I'm really pleased that you were on the show to talk about it. In closing, what do you hope readers will gain from reading Seeking Truth and Speaking Truth?
What the book does, Wesley, is simply tries to provide for a broader audience what I try to communicate to my students and indeed to my own children. And that is, all of us, despite the different callings that we have, some are called to be lawyers and others to be doctors, and some are going to be in the insurance business and some in the finance business, and some will be plumbers and some will be electricians and some will be housewives. And we're going to be called to all sorts of different things, but we all have one common feature of our vocation. Every single human being is called to be a determined truth seeker and a courageous truth speaker. And that's my message. That's what the book is really all about. It's a plea. The title itself is a plea. Please, be this. If you're not one already, make yourself strive to be a determined, sincere truth seeker and a courageous truth speaker. Don't value your own opinion so highly above the truth that you won't allow yourself to be challenged, lest you have to give up an opinion that turns out to be wrong. No, love truth even more than your own opinions. Be a sincere truth seeker. And then when you've gotten some truth, at least you're confident, however much you're able to, with some degree of confidence, affirm, then you got to be willing to speak the truth, even when it's hard, even when it's risky, even when you're making sacrifices to do it. Because, and this goes back to the other book, the one Cornell and I did together, truth matters. It matters that we live in line with reality and not with illusions and delusions. Let's not enter the matrix. Let's live with reality and let's do our best to try to be good people who do the right thing, even when it's hard.
You know, when you're not thinking deep thoughts, you have something in common with the comedian Steve Martin. You both play bluegrass banjo. Tell us about your love of music.
Well, as I say, I was born and brought up in the hills of West Virginia. I had a kind of Huck Finn boyhood, Wesley. I mean, I was hunting and fishing and playing bluegrass music and running around the hills. And I was a banjo player. I sometimes quip that banjos are issued to little boys at birth in West Virginia. That's not quite true. I got mine when I was 12. and I've played it and I've loved playing it ever since. I'm not currently playing with a band, but over the years I've played with many bluegrass ensembles. It's always been a great part of my life. It's also my link with my boyhood. It's my link with my home. If somebody asked me where I'm from, I don't say New Jersey. I don't say Princeton. I always just instinctively would say, you know, West Virginia, because that's the real me. And that banjo and banjo playing keeps me in touch with my roots and with myself.
And allows you to express the human creativity that is so important. I saw, by the way, Steve Martin in concert playing the banjo. It was joyful. We had a
he is and I had very a wonderful time. Very good. He used the banjo as many people have as part of his comedy routine in his early career. But he's a very serious banjo player, a very good one. I noticed during COVID, early on when we were all locked down, he started putting out banjo videos. And so I thought, well, that's a good idea. So I began matching his banjo videos. He'd put up one and then I'd put up one. And it was just, in his case and in my case, just 60 seconds or so of banjo music. And I'm sure I've never spoken with him. I've never met him, but I'll bet he was doing it for the same reason I was doing it. And that is to cheer people up. It's impossible to be sad when you hear banjo music.
That's
it's just joyful.
Right.
Joyful music. So I was trying to keep everybody's spirits up. I think I did in the end 66 banjo. I called them banjo minutes on Twitter.
But that's wonderful. And by the way, I have linked to the program notes some of your music videos.
Good.
So if people are interested to hear you, which I have in preparing for this interview, please just go hit the link. Well, we're out of time. What next for Professor Robert P. George?
Well, one of the blessed things about academic life is every few years you get an academic leave, and I have an academic leave coming up next year. I have one more semester of teaching this coming semester, this spring semester. I'll be teaching my big lecture course, undergraduate lecture course in civil liberties, and then also doing an upper level seminar for undergraduates called Natural Law and Natural Rights. And then I'll have a leave, and I'll be working on various book projects, trying to keep pressing on many of the themes of seeking truth and speaking truth. And I'll also be working on some institution building. I'm trying to encourage the creation of centers of civic education and classical education modeled on the Madison program here at Princeton that I founded 25 years ago. And it's really wonderful to see them springing up all over the country, including at the flagship state universities in Arizona, Texas, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, Ohio State, and now a new one's just been announced that they're going to build at the University of Michigan. And I've been involved in almost all of those projects. And I'm very heartened to see this revival of civic and classical education. So I'm going to be spending a good chunk of my leave trying to assist with building those programs.
Well, that just sounds very interesting. Well, Robert P. George, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it. And thanks for all of your good work.
My pleasure, Wesley. Thanks for having me back on the show. Hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.